So the pain scale in relationships, I think, goes something like this. You have a complete stranger who perhaps brushes you off or does something rude, and it hurts a little bit, but it's momentary. You have a close friend, and you experience the breaking of that relationship, and it hurts a bit. Then there's the pain of a parent-child estrangement that hits our hearts. And then maybe the most wounding of all, the betrayal of a marriage. And I think most of us have felt some of that pain on some level in one or more of those areas, many of us at the highest levels. And I want you for a second just to feel that pain. The sleepless nights, the inner turmoil, the longing for reconciliation. And then realize how telling and meaningful that the Lord uses the most painful of broken relationships, the latter two that we just said, to describe how he feels about his people and how in the end his love won't let go. The image for this series entitled A Love That Can't Let Go, don't know if we can put it on the screen there, it's on your bulletin as well, depicting just this passionate love that can't let go. The first section, chapter 1, verse 1 through 2, verse 1, really sets all of the themes and key concepts of the book up for us. It's a jarring and yet well-done introduction to the whole book. So this morning I want to introduce the three main actors in this drama in order to set the scene and really set up the entire book. And so it'll help if you have your outline in front of you. But we're going to talk about, number one, the request, where we'll meet Hosea and we'll meet Gomer as well. Number two, the reality, where we'll meet unfaithful Israel in verses 3 through 9. And then lastly, the reversal, where we meet faithful God in the last couple verses. So let's start with number one, the request, where we meet Hosea and Gomer. If you could press stop on the CD player, it's distracting me. It's coming through the monitors. Probably you can't hear it, but affecting me. So the request, meet Hosea and Gomer. Verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. The word Hosea, probably better to say Hosea, is what it would be. And that would, of course, bring back to mind names like from the same root word as Joshua, Yeshua, and Jesus. And so it just means salvation. And Hosea is placed in his time here in the 8th century BC, leading up to the eventual conquering and captivity of Israel, the northern kingdom by Assyria in 722, and we introduced all that last week. So Hosea is put in his time, and then verse 2 it says, when the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. So as a prophet, you know that anything might be asked of you. And some of the examples were shared on Wednesday at midweek of some of those stories in the Bible study. But it's hard to imagine a more shattering or shocking initial request from God than this. Go marry a prostitute or a promiscuous woman. Of course, some of the older Bible versions are actually a little less soft. Go marry a whore and have children with the whore, for this country is like a whore. Yikes. The Hebrew text here is actually even stronger in a way because it uses the same root word for whore or adulteress four different times, basically saying, marry an adulterer and have adulterous children, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of adultery to the Lord. So the translations kind of clean up that repetitiveness a little bit, but it's there, and we have something close to that. So what does all this mean? It's not clear necessarily whether Gomer was already a promiscuous or unfaithful woman or wife before Hosea married her, or whether this is what she became. And it's also not perfectly clear if the right translation is, you know, prostitute, promiscuous woman, unfaithful, but either way, you get sort of the picture. And the main point is that this verse is going to set up the entire book, as we outlined last week, with that key word, for. So go and marry this promiscuous woman, have children with her, for, like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. And that will really be the outline for the whole book. You have chapters 1 through 3, which is Hosea and the unfaithful wife and the faithful husband, and that story, which then is depicted in chapters 4 through 14 for real, what's going on with the unfaithful nation and faithful God. And so the point is, God is wanting to convey a message to Israel, and he feels so strongly and so passionately about what he feels that he does it in the most unexpected and unique way. Think for a second. To whom or what does God compare himself? Is he an authoritarian autocrat whose orders nobody questions and people obey out of fear? No. Is he a father who rejoices in his perfect little family, his adoring wife and children who just always get along? No. He is like a husband whose wife has left him. And we'll see, like a father whose children are like strangers in his own house and are destroying themselves. His is a dysfunctional family, not because he himself is dysfunctional or the cause of the dysfunction, but because the family, which is us, is dysfunctional. So God communicates what's happening not in theoretical language, but in graphic and real language of the home and of a problem family, situations that many of us know all too well. And in a way, words are just not enough sometimes. Words fail to communicate, particularly the broken heart of God. And so he will call on Hosea to act out in real life the embodiment of God's heart. So we're not really given much of an introduction of the book or the situation or what's going on, but the book just throws us right in. Go and marry an adulterous woman. God is essentially saying this: the scandal of one of my holy prophets marrying a prostitute is the same in scandal as me pledging myself to you, Israel, and your unfaithfulness. And so that brings us to the situation of Israel. The second point, the reality of the situation where we meet unfaithful Israel in verses 3 through 9. And we meet Israel dramatically through the names of the three children in this section. And so we'll break this section down by those three children. Notice kind of how the warnings and the names you'll see become more severe from the first to the third child. The intensity is increasing and the darkness grows deeper with each successive birth. So we start with Jezreel in verse 3. So he married Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Some people do allegorize all of chapters 1 through 3. Don't think that they literally happened. But I find that hard to accept due to the specific details given here, that she's the daughter of Diblaim, giving this specific thing. And then I think mostly, honestly, it has to do with people being so uncomfortable with what's going on here and the language, and particularly chapter 2, that they can't think that God would actually do this, and so they sort of dismiss it, almost can't accept it. But all indications are this really happened, and sometimes you just got to put God out of your box that you've created for him. And so Gomer bears Hosea a son, and it says in verse 4, the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. So we don't have time to revisit. They did a little bit on Wednesday morning. We don't have time to revisit the awful story of what happened at Jezreel in the Bible. You can read it in 2 Kings 9 and 10. But it was a bloodbath. And God had not forgotten it. The best way to really communicate what's happening and naming your son Jezreel and what that would have been like for God to say that is that, you know, it would be like a politician or a leader in Rwanda naming their son genocide. Or it would be like a politician or leader in the United States naming their child Ground Zero or 9/11. Or it would be like somebody in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, naming their son Sandy Hook. It would constantly be a reminder of this great tragedy that had happened. A name you would no way want for your child. And God says, name him Jezreel, for I will not forget the hypocrisy, the bloodshed done in the name of religion like that happened at Jezreel. There's also some wordplay and other meaning here. First, Jezreel obviously sounds like Israel even more in the Hebrew. God is saying, you know, you are more like Yisrael than Yisrael. Because of Yisrael, I will put an end to Yisrael. And significantly, as we'll soon see, the word Jezreel means God scatters, pointing ahead to the exile and the judgment that is coming. So that's strong, but God even kind of puts one last zinger in there to Israel in verse 5, where he says, in that day I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. And if you know your Old Testament a little bit, the imagery of God breaking the bow is actually almost always a positive thing, that he's going to break the bow of other nations for Israel. But here God says, I'm going to break the bow of Israel. The Valley of Jezreel, which was a major pass through the mountains connecting the northern and southern kingdom and therefore a major battleground. It was the site of Gideon's great victory in Judges 6 and 7, but it will soon be remembered for Assyria marching its way through the valley, taking Israel into captivity and being scattered among the nations. So the first name is Jezreel. And then the second name, Loruhamah. Tells us in verse 6 that Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Loruhamah, which means not loved, for I will no longer show love to Israel that I should at all forgive them. First thing to notice is that the second and third children are not actually said to be Hosea's. The bore him of verse 3 is missing, and commentators almost unanimously in the text itself points us in this direction, agree that Hosea was not the father of these children, adding to the deeply conflicting feelings in the story and the portrait of unfaithfulness, that Hosea is asked to stand alongside and even love, as we'll see, this wife who has borne children with others and love the children who are actually not even his own. And so the name Loruhamah, not love, takes on even deeper significance. The intensification here from Jezreel to Loruhamah is felt. I mean, it's kind of one thing to lose a war, right, and to be carried off with your family, but to still know that you are loved and you still have your loving family or your loving God with you, but that, say, you are going to be scattered and you're going to become not loved, increases the intensity of what's going on. But God has been left with no choice, for his mercy and his compassion and his forgiveness are empty without any kind of response from a people. And as we said last week, it's you hear the heart cry of the prophet Jesus, who Hosea, the grieving prophet, points to, who says, how often I have longed to gather you together, but you were not willing. But it's his longing. So verse 7, however, helps put verse 6 in a little bit of context. As with many of the prophets, often these oracles of doom, like in verse 6, are warnings given in an attempt to actually avert the very judgment being proclaimed. And so Jeremiah 18, 7 and 8 gives this principle. It says, if at any time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be uprooted, torn down, and destroyed. And if that nation, I warned, repents of its evil, then I will relent and not inflict on it the disaster I had planned." So it's really a temporal state of God's feelings, but not part of his eternal disposition to his people, as we saw last week. It's not God's desire to judge. In fact, the persistence of his compassion is so strong and overwhelming that mercy just can't help but break forth in this book's proclamations of judgment. And so even here, somewhat suddenly comes verse 7. "Yet I will show love to Judah, and I will save them, not by bow, sword, or battle, or by horses and horsemen, but I, the Lord, their God, will save them." But before things get better, things will actually get worse. So we come to the third child. Lo Ami, not my people. Verses 8 and 9, "After she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, 'Call him Lo Ami,' which means 'not my people,' for you are not my people, and I am not your God." So imagine Hosea finding out once again that Gomer is pregnant with a child not his own, born in adultery. The feelings that this was not his child and the sadness that that must have created must have been hard to shake. And yet even more sad are the words to Israel, "You are not my people." Part of the point here is that Hosea would probably have been justified, and it would have been accurate to say, "This is not my child." And God would be justified to say the same thing to Israel, who had went after other gods and had become a child of the world, not a child of God. So the intensification has built from "I will scatter you," to "you are not loved," to "you are not my people." And Hosea embodies this in the feelings of God, having to name his son Jezreel, having two children apparently not his. I mean, the pain that must have caused, the temptation to not love them or call them his own. And then on top of that, the pain of being married to this unfaithful spouse, one who will eventually leave him, as we'll see next week. I mean, what can Hosea do? What should he do? He would certainly have been justified in leaving Gomer. And of course, the real question is, what will God do? He would be justified in saying, "I'm finding a new family." But even though some of Hosea's and God's initial reactions are tough because they're hurt, they above all, in the end, are tender. And we hear the echo of Hosea 11:8, God saying, "How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel?" Although Israel, like Gomer with Hosea, has made a fool of God and herself, he will not waver from his love and mercy. And so we move to our last introduction and our last section, which is the reversal. And this is where we meet faithful God, where it says, "Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' they will be called children of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. So say to your brothers, 'My people,' and your sisters, 'My loved one.'" I mean, it almost feels like the chapter shouldn't actually end this way after what we just read. It almost doesn't feel right, and yet it's who God is. As we've said, one of the main themes in this book is the interplay or the tension between God's judgment and his mercy, his wrath and his love, and how wrath is temporal, but love is eternal. And the primary message of Hosea is God's compassion. He is faithful even when we are not. Love keeps winning in this book, and it wins in this section as well. just as we outlined the last section by the three names, we can kind of outline this one by the complete and astounding reversal of those three names and the oracles of doom they represent. So let's take them in ascending order of intensity so you can see this. So Israel, who was scattered, Jezreel, becomes Israel, come together. The first half of verse 10, yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. And that's, of course, alluding back to the promises to Abraham. God is saying, I will hold my promise. I can't let go. And then verse 11, the people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. And so here the meaning of Jezreel, God scattered, is actually reversed. Whereas before it referred to them being gathered together by Assyria and scattered by God in exile away from their land, here it actually refers to the agricultural use of the term, that you scatter seed and it gets planted and then is firmly rooted, which is why we get the language that up out of the land will come a leader for one. And of course, I think it points to the tree of Jesse, the root of Jesse, the son of David, Jesus Christ, who will come and gather the people together. And so the once scattered will now come together. Not only that, but the promise is that this divided kingdom of north and south, Israel and Judah, will also come together. Reconciliation. There will be a single people of God. And then the trajectory of this promise goes even further, all the way into the New Testament, describing and embracing now even Gentiles, even us, even me and you. And so Paul quotes this in Romans 9:25. He says, just as God says in Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people. I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. 1 Peter refers to this promise in 2:10 as well. Once you were not my people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. And therefore, we ourselves are included in this promise. Listen to what the gospel writer John says in John 11, 51, 52. Just came alive like never before to me this week. Where he says, Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. It's the fulfillment, ultimately, of the great reversal that happens in Hosea. And then, secondly, the not loved becomes my loved one. The last verse of this section. Say to your brothers, my people, and your sisters, my loved one. And then also we'll group these together. Not my people becomes my people. So first, the second half of verse 10. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called children of the living God. And then as we just read, say to your brothers, my people. So there's a giving of a new name. The low, the not, is dropped. And they are just given a new name. It is a pure act of grace. In this section, Hannah tells me from the Bible Study Wednesday, there are 11 promises of hope and 8 lines of judgment. Even though the situation warrants about a 20-to-1 ratio of judgment versus hope, Israel did not deserve hope. They did not deserve the restoration of the promises of God. They did not deserve new names. They had done nothing to deserve it. And of course, that is the point, because that is grace. Notice the shift in language to this more familial and intimate language, that they are now children of the living God, not divorced, not my people of dead idols. They are now the daughter, where it just says a daughter, who is not loved in verse 6, says now, your sisters, my loved ones. The another son, who is not my people in verse 8 and 9, is now your brothers, my people. It's unexplainable, it's undeserved, and it always was and it always is. God told Israel in Deuteronomy 7, verses 7 through 9, that the Lord did not set his affection on you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you. He is the faithful God. So let's move to then the application of what this all means for us as followers of Jesus, if we are. As we said last week, part of the point of studying this book is to know and then feel and adopt the heart of God, his breaking heart for his people. And yes, it can hurt to take on God's heart, but we're called to follow his example. And so three quick applications are just kind of things to chew on. Number one, pretty simple, God loves, and so should we. And more particularly, God loves the loveless and the unlovable, and so should we. Our love is not contractual. Not if it's the love of God, anyway. It is covenantal, the way God's is. Meaning, we do not love with a contract mentality that I will provide you with this love, and in return, I expect something back for my love. I mean, yes, of course, it's best when you love and you feel love in return. But Israel was not holding up its end. But God continued to love because of his covenant, because of that word we've defined before, his chesed, his covenant faithfulness to Israel. And so in our love, we love others, especially the unlovable, without any expectation of return and without any limits on our love. That was the message of the Great Samaritan that we looked at a few months ago, that parable. And if you're not loving those who won't or can't love you in return, then you're not going to find expression for the heart of God that he's called you to. There has to be people in your life that you're loving that can give you nothing in return, and in fact, even maybe reject your love. Otherwise, you will not feel the close heart of God. Secondly, application, we let love win. Let love win. Let love cover a multitude of sins. Let it win out over jealousy and anger and bitterness and resentment and wrongs and hurts and judgment. Because if not, we're in danger of missing out on allowing God's own love to win our own hearts. As many of the parables and teachings of Jesus demonstrate, yes, forgiveness is a free gift and it is open to us, but if we refuse to forgive others, we disqualify ourselves from that forgiveness. Listen, as I said last week, I know that love is painful. I know that it hurts to love. And as in this text, it's the people you love who hurt you the most. And therefore, it's tempting to run away from those encounters. And perhaps you've been hurt. You've been hurt maybe even by God's people, by the church. And so you're afraid to get close. You're afraid to be all in because you know that as you grow in love, also the potential for disappointment grows. And I understand that. I know, I feel the temptation. And as I said last week, but avoiding that, to me, is not a life worth living. To just play it safe and not love because of the potential disappointment and hurt that can come. Because one of the best ways we can feel and act out the heart of God is to have a stubborn love that won't let go. And man, I know it's early on in this series, but for me, this is by far already the most challenging part of studying this book together, is trying to say, God, I want to love like you love, but it's hard when you see how radical God's love is in this book. And will I love like God loves? Will you love like God loves? Will we let ourselves be loved by God and by others the way He desires? Will we risk ourselves in love? Will we let love win? Will we let it rule and reign in our families, in our communities, and in this family here? And then lastly, as the band comes up, God is and will always be the God of reversal. He is the God of reversal. I want you to just close your eyes for a reflective moment here as we take these images and we turn them into prayer before the Lord. Many of you perhaps find yourselves this morning maybe in need of a great reversal. You need God to just come into your life and do a total 180 on some circumstances. I think it's telling that God uses this allegory of the pain and brokenness of family to get His point across, saying, nothing is impossible for me. I can turn anything around because He is the God of great reversals. And more than anything, He loves to put a reversal on people's lives, to completely and utterly turn them around, to reverse our hearts. Do you want the God of reversal to come in, to completely rearrange your life? Nobody's saying it's easier. In fact, it's scary, but it is awesome to engage the heart of God. It's everything you were meant and designed to be, namely a part of His family, a child of God, adopted into His family. So will you go from being not His people, not receiving mercy, to being His people? Do you want to be a part of His forever family where He won't let go, where His love is truly unconditional? Then if so, and maybe for some it's the first time, maybe for others you've wandered away, you've cut yourself off from the family of God, but just tell Him. Tell Him you want to be a part of His family. Ask Him to come and to forgive you of your sins. That even though you have been scattered, we come together now under the cross of Christ as one people, one family, under one God, one faith, and one baptism, and we are His people. He never left you. You might have left Him, but He never left you. He is right there saying, I never let go. So if He is calling you to that today, just turn those feelings into prayers before God. Doesn't matter what you say, but just express truth. Express the depths of your heart to Him. And for those of us who are perhaps already believers in the family of God, will you engage the heart of God? It's one thing to say we love God. It's another thing to let His love transform our hearts in the way we see things, feel things, see situations. Will you believe Him to be the God of great reversal in circumstances around you? Will you keep loving in those circumstances where you're afraid to give up? Just call out to Him. He will give you faith. Nobody wants you to have His heart more than He does. So let His tenderness draw you. He's not a distant God. Maybe you've projected images onto God that are not true. I just say, may the enemy take those untruths away from your heart of who God is and what he's like. He's not a dictator, as we see in this text. He's not an authoritarian. He is a broken-hearted God. Yeah, he wants our obedience, but he won't coerce or oppress us into it. He just calls us into covenant love. That good and perfect place in the will of God. There's nothing like it. Nothing can compare to it.